This is Do You Think I'm Frightening? Written by Oddishly and recorded by Tipsy Kitty. Steed comes back. Eventually. Kinda. It's surprising. No one's ever come back for Ed before, and definitely not someone Ed actually asked to come back for him. So it's worth examining. Mostly Ed wants to know why now. Usually the way it goes when Ed wants something is he lifts a knife or a sword or a frying pan over his head. And in the half second before it goes down again into someone's skull or chest or ballsack, he looks desperately to the sky and thinks, I hope he rolls away. Or,
still got one working leg, mate. Up you get. Go.
Or, if I turn around and count to 17, then maybe he won't be here when I turn back. Except the person never does any of those things, and Ed always ends up hurting them. When the person he wants to come back is someone he actually asks to come back, usually it's on a sunset beach a little way beyond a prison that's also, weirdly, freedom. That's the way things always seem to go with the person he asks to come back. Usually, Ed makes a little speech about stuff. He doesn't remember what, because it's frankly pretty exhausting flaying himself raw like that, even when he's just remembering doing the flaying. But the gist is that he's sick of Blackbeard and everything that comes with it, the having to be on all the time, and the endless manifests, and playing chicken with the Navy, and the sucking, yawning pit of misery that lives somewhere between his bottom two ribs and the small of his back. He doesn't always say that stuff out loud, but he reckons it's implicit, and when the person he's talking to is someone he'd asked to come back, it seems like all that should be pretty explicit, actually, because Ed literally just gave it all up for him, just like that. Anyway, then usually he ends up at, reckon what makes Ed happy is, and then he kisses the person. And then some other stuff happens, don't worry about it. And then eventually the person comes back after all. So, technically, Ed has a 100% success rate in people who come back when asked, versus people who don't. It's hard to feel much of anything that isn't the shriek that took charge of breathing somewhere around some other stuff happens. Killing people feeds the shriek, so at least that's something. Most of the time it sits somewhere on the inside, slicking him up and patching the holes like tar, and pushing organs out of the way to make room for itself. And it keeps Ed busy. He has to fill the time with something. Otherwise, he might as well have not come back either. Making lists of reasons to stay alive only gets him so far. He kills a bloke, or two, or 20, and a woman, or 20, and a priest, or a vicar. Is there a difference? And then a few more people just for good measure, because they get in the way, and because it's easier than listening to them talk to him and each other. Steed's quarters stay exactly how they were with Steed in them, without any changes. And if you see anything different, then no you don't. Shut up. Except for how there's no Steed, that part's obvious, and it doesn't need saying, and especially not out loud. Which is mostly why Ed's mostly stopped saying it out loud. For instance, one Monday, Frenchie says, remember how Cap used to read his bedtime stories? In his wistful, sort of more or less Bristolian accent. Ed looks at him and says, Cap?
Cap who?
And Frenchie says, oh,
no one?
Ed snorts.
What kind of captain calls himself Captain No One?
Frenchie opens his mouth. Then he closes it. Then he opens it.
He looks like a goldfish.
The deck's gone quiet, so everyone must be listening for the answer. Everyone includes Ed. Frenchie appears to have run out of words. Still, he's not running away, is he? Which makes this practically a conversation. Nice. Ed hasn't had a conversation in a bit, so he decides to keep talking, just to make sure he doesn't forget how.
No fucking pirate I know goes around calling himself that. You ever met a pirate before? Can't be notorious when you're going around selling yourself as nothing. Like, maybe if he wants to be a fucking ghost captain or something.
Although, that's actually an idea. Pretty cool one, actually, huh? Ed squints at Frenchie with new interest.
You know a ghost captain?
Nah, The ghost captain's captain.
Well, that's disappointing. Why'd you bring it up, then?
I didn't. That was you?
He's pretty obviously lying, but Ed nods. Makes sense. You know, ghost captain, you're not gonna just give him up to Blackbeard. That's the sort of thing idiots do, and Frenchie's not stupid, is he? Odd sometimes, but no harm in that. Look at Izzy. Look at Anne fucking Bonnie, for fuck's sake. Doesn't get weirder than old Annie, and she's so good at piracy that she doesn't even have to do it anymore. A brave little trickle of longing makes itself known in Ed's chest. The shriek eats it. Frenchie's feet shuffle. Right. Ed's still staring at him. Smart bloke like Frenchie probably gets nervous at things like that. So Ed looks up at the topsail and opens his mouth to continue this interesting-as-fuck conversation about ghost captains. Except Frenchie, the wily fucker, gets in first with,
"To be honest, I just didn't see you come up on deck, Captain. I was referring to, Captain, the gentleman pirate, Captain.
The gentle." When Ed opens his eyes again a few seconds later, it's dark and there are bodies on the deck that he's almost positive weren't there earlier. But at least the shriek is quiet. Maybe Ed was just too busy having his conversation to notice the bodies. If Frenchie was still around, Ed could have asked him, but he's not. He must be in the ballroom, or the jam room, or one of the other rooms below deck that isn't here with Ed. Probably for the best. If all it takes is one stimulating conversation to lose track of what was on deck an hour ago and what wasn't, you wouldn't want yourself distracted either. He puts conversation in the box in his mind labeled Ed, and tries to forget it's there. The Ed box has some cool things in it. A smoking pipe. A medicine jar with a lick of arsenic still inside. Bunch of ideas for tattoos to give people. Whole lot of rum. A lamp shaped like a two-headed sea snake eating a shark while the shark eats the other head off the snake. Ed would fucking love to see that in real life. Actually spent a while following this one injured shark for a couple of weeks, back somewhere around the time life started getting boring in the 1690s, just in case a sea snake showed up. But the shark went belly up too quick, literally. The rough white skin on its underside looking slimy one day, and all flaky and dried up the next, bobbing alongside the ship in the sun like a really gross buoy. No two-headed snake showed up to eat it before it sank, which meant Ed should have shot and eaten it himself. Or maybe that would have made him the snake. Something to consider. The shriek yawns. Frenchie sticks his head into the cabin while Ed is spinning a dagger on the desk and ruminating on his own snakiness. Stellar timing as always. Ed stows the dagger in the ceiling where he can't lose it and raises friendly eyebrows at the door. Frenchie gulps. Ed waits. Sup. And then he waggles the eyebrows and lowers his voice in jocular fashion.
First Mate Venturson?
Yeah, says Frenchie. He comes all the way inside and snaps his heels together. Another man might call him nervous, but Ed knows better.
About that, Captain.
It's a tad formal for Ed's liking, but maybe that just means this is a new type of ship. New first mate, new crew. New management style. Ed doesn't correct him. He straightens in his chair, then decides that it's better to stand. Ed's formal ship isn't the kind where the captain lounges back with his legs apart and his fingers spread on his kneecaps, while the crewman stands and sweats in the square foot of floor between the desk and the door with his hands behind his back to show deference. It's the kind where the captain shows due respect to his colleagues, who, after all, are the ones doing all the hard work of looting and musicking up on deck, while the captain rips all the kissing pages out of books, and gets stuck at the very top of his list of reasons to be alive, and cries in bed with the pages under his pillow.
It's just,
says Frenchie.
Well, it's an honor. I had my eye on the first mate job for ages, obs, but I just wanted to check that you think I'm really the best man for the job. Lots of other options on the crew. Lots of looks with a fair bit more pirating under their belts than I have.
Don't know if I'm qualified, really.
Seems like I might be missing some of the essential qualifications. Feels like I might have skipped the queue, as it were. Ed waits patiently for Frenchie to be done, then a few seconds more to be polite.
Essential qualifications, like what?
Oh, well, like, say, killing people, for one. Not the best killer on board. Not even close, if I'm honest, Captain.
Ed snorts.
Duh. No one's the best killer on board when Jim's around.
Frenchie's nodding like one of those thingies you stuff on a bookshelf and bop with the quill to make its head go up and down in its neck socket.
Jim, yeah. Way more qualified than I am, but they'd be up for it. Actually, they're probably... I could go get him now. What do you think?
Could have a chat about reallocating job titles, pay scale, responsibilities, and that sort of thing.
If Ed hadn't already known Frenchie was the right man for the job, this conversation would have cinched it. And would you look at that? Now he's at two conversations. Ed's going to have to watch out to make sure he doesn't get a reputation for being chatty.
He rounds the desk to give Frenchie a nice, manly, hearty slap between the shoulder blades.
Knew it picked right.
First mate, Jim. Can you imagine? I'd have a knife in my chest before I could even give him the go-ahead to off you.
He leaves the hand on Frenchie's back and laughs from his stomach.
Sign on the door'd say Captain Jimenez before I even hit the deck.
Seems like they could probably manage that now, Captain.
Yeah, but we're good, me and Jim. Right now they've got a job, a bunk, wedding cake for breakfast. Shit like that keeps people happy. Problems only start when you make a guy first mate. That's when they start getting ideas about running things.
Frenchie's still standing awkwardly under Ed's hand. Ed slides his arm all the way around his shoulders, gives him a good squeeze to make him feel better.
Have some faith in yourself, man. Anyone starts giving you lip about jumping the line, you know what to do.
Frenchie turns his head to look at him. Ed draws an illustrative line across his own throat with a finger, and then sticks out his tongue. Then he grins. It's probably pretty freaky looking with his tongue out, so he doubles down and lifts a hand to shoot himself in the head with a finger gun. He tops it off by pulling the knot up an imaginary noose, neck to ceiling, head tipping as he goes.
Take your pick.
Eventually, Frenchie leaves. Ed climbs up onto the desk to retrieve his dagger, feeling good about himself. Good chat, he thinks, although it got a bit informal at the end there. Something for him and Frenchie to work on. He locates his list on the desk, just while he's thinking about it, and draws a line under the Alive heading. Below it he writes, find out if two-headed sea snakes are real, and then find a shark and make them eat each other. Then, can't abandon Frenchie 10 minutes into the job. Takes Steed a bit to get there. He's practically perfect, but he's still new. His fragile sense of direction and corresponding fumbling ability to navigate from wherever it is he went that wasn't straight to Ed, leaves a bit to be desired. No shame in that. Probably Ed's fault anyway for staring at him in the fucking moonlight instead of teaching him how to get around. And Ed has to laugh at himself a bit at this, which makes a couple of nameless crew jump and scuttle away, for making Steed stab him in the fucking moonlight instead of teaching him how to get around. The fuck kind of twat doesn't check that the feeling's mutual before making the other guy stab you? Ed, that's the fucking twat who. It'd have been nice to pretend for a bit there, though. Relaxing. When was the last time Ed was relaxed? Summer linens? Says a lovely, glowing, stabbed-up Steed in Ed's memory. Autumn by. The Ed box has some natty outfits in it. This part of the Ed box doesn't just live in Ed's head. Some of it exists in real life, too. In the auxiliary wardrobe that Steed didn't need anymore. Fine. 'Cause now he's gone, Ed can use it for himself. In the box, there's all his leather, which predated and then continued on with Blackbeard, the purple crop top, the prison garb, a couple other outfits that he's saving for the day he finds a mirror intact. The Shriek doesn't like it when he tries,
But Ed has an inkling that winning the gunfight on deck in steel-toe-capped boots and black eyeliner might be enough to get away with wearing something slinky and form-fitting, too. But first, a mirror. Ed doesn't want to go out there looking stupid, God forbid. In the days after a week of storms that leave the sea full of ships ripe for the picking, the sun now brilliant and the breeze carrying the putrid smell of death and overconfidence, Ed goes hunting. He flicks the ship around the waves like a drunkard stumbling home in the dawn, looting and burning and taking heads and money chests along the way. A schooner to get them started, pitching so far to its port side that it might have been sunk by its own cargo during the storms, protected by an outcropping that would have broken the fetch wind in its tracks, leaving Ed to pluck and plunder a day later. Then a cutter, helpless with the mast snapped in half, not doing much beyond holding the sails in place for a sunshade on deck. A longship, with its two skeleton crew, all speaking language Ed has never heard before, which is new and pretty interesting, must have lost their way on their travels west. Shame he can't ask them before killing them and setting the water churning with their bodies. But the tea and silks in the hold speak for themselves. Finally he gets lucky. A matching pair of English East Indiamen, heavy with sugar, tobacco, and newly ruined tapestries, and a matching sodden pair of crews putting up less than half a fight as they trundle around the sea trying to make repairs. In each of the captain's quarters, Ed finds fancy wooden desks holding fancy gilded mirrors. "Ooh," says Fang, when Ed drags him inside the first room to show off the loot, in the Baroque style. "You don't see much of that these days. They must have been coming back from Italy." "You think?" "Oh, yeah," says Fang. "It's all in the..." He uses his hand to outline the top and sides of the gilding in a way that would have probably meant something to an Italian Baroque-making mirror maker. "Good find, Captain. You make a lot of money off this, I reckon." Ed battles with the burning desire to accept Fang's impressed approval, and the corresponding desire not to have to throw a sheet over it every time Fang comes to the door. Which is, admittedly, not often these days. Truth wins out for once. "Think I'm going to keep this one, actually." "Oh?" Fang's eyes go wide, meeting Ed's in the glass. "All right, Captain. Everyone deserves a little treat like this." A scoff sounds mean and loud in Ed's chest. He squashes it and lets a bead of happiness roll around his chest instead.
"A treat?"
"Yeah, I think it's nice, and..." Fang's gaze goes around the room before continuing.
"Bet the other ship's got one of these, too. You could keep the nicer one, sell the other."
Ed can't help it. He beams right at Fang and says,
"Already checked. Think I might keep both. Balance them on top of each other."
He draws a shape in the air like so.
"Stick them to the back of the door or something, so I know I'm made appropriate when I get up in the morning."
Steed would have done that. Fang's eyes widen again. This time it's off, though, a bit wary. Maybe I'd said the wrong thing. Maybe two mirrors is one little treat too many. Whatevs. Steed would also have taken both mirrors. He'd have stuck that magnificent nose in the air and walked off with the mirror under either arm. Or, more likely, enlisted Lucius to take one, and the cook for the other, and then bitched at both of them about not scraping gold plating against the bulkheads. Ed, who isn't Steed and doesn't need him anyway, hoists the mirror off the desk and balances it flat on his head to walk away with. He ignores whatever conversational noises Fang makes because he doesn't need anyone else's opinion. That's what the mirrors are for. By nighttime, Ed has the mirrors balanced on top of each other in the cabin, as planned. The whole ornate Baroque frame thing makes it hard to fit them together, but Ed doesn't mind. It's kind of fun to see himself cut in two by gilt and gold. Stupid fun. But what else is he going to do with the matched pair of mirrors if not balance them on top of the other and parade around in front of them? He starts in his leathers, because that's what he's been wearing since Steed didn't come back. Better to find out now if he's got to go out and do some damage control. One quick look at the top mirror tells him he's got nothing to worry about. The person looking back is pretty freaking scary looking. Not a face he'd want to stumble into in the middle of battle. Well, maybe. It's got a thing or two he'd like to say to the person wearing that face. But he's not so far gone that he's going to start actually saying them to the mirror. He stares at the dark eyes staring back until he can't bear them anymore. Then he turns back to the chest, temporarily relocated from the auxiliary wardrobe to block the door to the cabin. An enticing mess of fabric spill over the sides. Waistcoats from a raid last week. A silk pajama set from the month before. Shoes. A nice pair of stockings. Although Ed has to acknowledge that he's seen nicer, not so long ago. A big new pair of boots. So new that he can still smell the leather under the sea salt steadily working into the cracks. Under the boots, a thick cloak that puts Ed in a mind to journey a long, long way south, where the sails glitter and gleam with frost in the morning. And all that survives the brutal cold below are the blue whales vanishing into the dark. Below that are bridal gowns, a whole array of them, all in different colors and designs. One the vibrant green of the ocean in spring, the skirt sweeping wide circles across the floor. One in lace, the starry design so small, so intricate that it makes Ed's fingers hurt to look at it, although he likes rubbing the sleeves between his fingers anyway. One the same brilliant purple-green as the southern lights, prettier in the sky, but nice to look at anyway. The gauzy midnight slip, so narrow that it bunches at Ed's hips until he mans up and gives the skirt a good strong tug on either side. And then he can't do much more than totter back and forth in pigeon steps before the mirror, scared of tearing the seams if he lengthens his stride at all. Ed gorges himself on his treasures, one outfit after another, until his blood is thrumming with adrenaline and the cabin is strewn with color. Eventually, the chest is empty. Just a heavy doorstop against a door. Not quite big enough to hold the dresses. Still a great and mighty cavern to keep all the parts of Ed he wants to keep safe. One or two of those parts might even get lost in there. Some of them might already be gone. There's a knock at the door. The type of knock that kind of screams, lost a wager.
Captain? Says Frenchie.
So obviously Ed was wrong about the wager bit. He feels bad for making assumptions. The door handle jangles in place. Ed's pleasure at the new clothes goes sour in his mouth, his insides rancid, the shriek waking back up and stretching its jaw around some of Ed's important parts. He sucks an urgent heaving breath of all the air in the room and grabs an armful of clothes from the door, dumping them into the chest to weigh it down some more before Frenchie can get in. He's wearing the slip and an awesome wide-brimmed cowboy hat that he had thought made him look an intriguing combination of girlish and rakish at once. Now Frenchie's at the door, he's just a bloke in a dress with a hat that he doesn't need, and that doesn't go anyway, and he has to fix it. He slides silently across the deck like one of those bugs that skates on lake water, piling clothes in his arms and sending a rip high up his stocking.
Captain?
Frenchie tries the door handle again, right as Ed silently dumps his next armful in the chest. He puts his foot up against the door as well, figuring way too close to disaster that even skinny from rhino horn and wretched with sleeplessness, he's still heavier than a bunch of stolen ladies' dresses in a box. And then he plants a smile on his face to sell it. No emergencies here, just a closed door.
Yeah, First Mate Frencherson, sup?
Oh, it's just Frenchie, actually, Captain. Ed is awestruck. He thinks about falling over, he's so impressed. Instead, he puts a hand flat against the wall for support and blinks at himself in the mirror and doesn't say anything. So it's that easy to go by the name you want to be called. A quick little correction and poof, it's just Frenchie, actually.
It's just Ed, actually.
Ed tries out to the mirror and sees the shriek bear its teeth back.
Although,
Frenchie continues helpfully into the silence.
Not like I couldn't be Mr. Frencherson.
Had a mate once who went by something similar.
Not really a mate, more like a ship's captain, but what's good for the goose is good for the gander, eh? What do you go by?
Jameson, Captain.
Long for James?
Nah, Jameson was just his name, but it worked for him. Could work for me, too.
First Mate Frencherson. Got a bit of a ring to it, if that's the kind of first mate you're looking for,
Captain. It's getting tired of holding the door closed with his foot. Was there something you wanted, Frenchie? Frenchie provides a sparing description of the naval warship spoiling the clear view of the sunset horizon. Everyone likes a sunset, and no one likes a warship, except Blackbeard. Blackbeard and Blackbeard's crew. Ed sighs. Some minutes later, alone again with the shriek and the mirrors, freed from the silly blue slip by ripping up the seams, he shoves the Ed box back into the wardrobe. Although he leaves the door open this time, because it's not like anyone's going poking around in there anyway. The only one brave enough to make it to the cabin in the last week is Frenchie. Maybe the mirrors will break while he's out killing people. Ed's never had 7 years of really bad luck. He thinks it might be fun. Nice to have a bit of certainty for once. The cabin door he closes as he leaves. Amen, says someone in his memory who doesn't exist anymore, to someone who must be dead by now, in a room that looked a bit like this one once. Ed finds a literal saber on the warship. A saber? How freaking cool is that? It used to be the Navy captain's. This one's Spanish. And he's got all sorts of cool shit pinned up around his walls the way some people pin butterflies, or so Steed said once. If you ask Ed, pinning butterflies is weird in a, like, all right, you do you, kind of way. But when you've got a saber, you use it. Since the Spanish captain doesn't see things the same way, and also he's dead now, Ed emerges from below with the saber in hand and looks around the near silent deck, dark-eyed white men in every inch of space. He sighs regretfully as he reaches the top of the steps. Don't really feel like giving quarter today. Ed prances around deck, wielding his prize like he was born with it in hand. The Navy crew must double Ed's at least, but that doesn't matter. He likes a challenge, and apparently so does his own crew. He gives the saber some swipes, a vicious jab this way and a smooth stab that, pulling it back to him with noses and small intestines and gaudy necklaces attached, sticks what he likes in his pockets, and before long he's the one winning at killing and maiming. There's all the normal hollering and begging for God and mercy and attempts to trip him overboard, but with the saber Ed's fucking invincible. He spins and darts and whirls, the blade cutting a magnificent arc through the starlit spray of blood and sea foam. He stands narrow and silent behind a mast, and when the cabin boy staggers to the other side for a moment's respite from battle, Ed materializes on the other side and runs him through. He snakes up the same mast and somersaults from halfway up for the pleasure of leaping and breaking his fall on the bosun's neck. He doesn't need to take a breath because he's not a body anymore. He's becoming one with his weapon. The shriek is howling the way a hurricane does, turning the air in his lungs into something vengeful, unstoppable, and wild. One of his own crew is crouching behind a cask a span is shot. Kind of weird way to go about a raid, but it doesn't matter. Ed doesn't need a crew, and he doesn't hesitate. He leaves his crewman where he cowers, and lets a saber carry him from one uniform to another, catching necks and ribs and feet as he goes, no longer concerned with how many, but now with how few. One of the older sailors tries to crawl overboard, so Ed cuts his legs off above the knee to discourage him. Drowning's a horrible death. Another one who can't be older than 12 is trying to play dead underneath the bodies of his friends. He's not doing a very good job of it. He's crying pretty loudly, actually, audible even from under all the bodies. So Ed nicely pretends he's not there and moves on to cut a final throat or two, and check there's no one likely to stage a last-minute uprising. When he's finally satisfied, he perches halfway along the bowsprit, legs dangling, and swipes blood from his face and finally draws a breath of his own. It's unusually quiet for a battle scene, just the clement slap of the waves on the hull and wounds oozing on the deck, but not a threatening gurgle or groan to be heard. So he hears the thin, uncomfortable scrape of air in his throat, the whistle of it in his teeth, like whatever it is living inside of the spaces inside his body doesn't need as much air as he's used to reaching for. He opens his eyes. It's not just the other crew that's gone quiet. His own seem to have forgotten how to celebrate a raid that went right, too. There should be the cacophony of boots racing between rooms below deck, and cannons being rolled out of the way, and the whisper of little paper umbrellas being stuck in rum and citrus drinks as they're handed to Ed. But aside from all the bodies, the deck is empty. Not a paper umbrella to be found. Maybe the Spanish sailors killed Ed's crew. Maybe Ed did. Ed waits for some sort of emotion to strike, and finds everything else in the way, stretching and trampling, looking for a place to sleep in the places that used to house a beating heart. Blood continues oozing into the deck. Killing the boy would have been a kindness. Just look at all the cleanup he's got ahead of him. Before Ed has to summon the will to dredge up a feeling of his own, he hears a clatter from behind a casket on the poop deck, and sees a familiar head pop up. It's the woman with all the tattoos. Ed knows her. He's peeked at the tattoos and wished his snake was as good. Sweet oxygen fills his lungs at the sight of her.
"Core,"
she says. No particular look on her face that Ed can recognize. Eyes not particularly wide, and mouth not particularly grimacy. But she makes core sound like, "Christ almighty, mates." And, "I didn't know Spanish guys had that many bones in them." Well, out of them, I suppose. And, "That's Blackbeard, all right." And other things like that. It's that last one that makes Ed uncertain. He hops off the bowsprit and ambles toward the snake woman. And by the time he's reached her, familiar heads have popped back up all over the place. None of them are heads he particularly wants to see, but none of them are pointing and yelling instructions to kill him anywhere, so probably they're all the right heads.
"Captain,"
says the snake woman as he gets close, deferential in that insufferable way that reminds Ed that he's alone and always will be. He swallows the sting and looks at her. She shapes her mouth into a smile and continues with,
"Cool, man. You showed him."
"The fuck does that mean?" Ed tips his head.
"Showed him what?"
"Who's boss?"
"Huh?"
"You know, with the stabbing and shit. You showed him."
Ed's getting anxious just listening to her not make sense. This whole fucking thing wasn't his idea. He just showed up when the situation called for it.
"You were here too, weren't you?"
He looks her over and uses the saber as a pointing stick for the bits of internal organs still stuck on her knife.
"Why aren't you the boss?"
Her smile stutters.
"Oh, I don't want to be boss. I'm not cut out for leadership, me. Too fucking clumsy." "Then why me? Why not?"
Ed swings the saber around behind him and jabs it randomly at
this guy. "Why can't he be the boss?"
"Yo tampoco quiero ser el jefe."
"Too fucking right, mate. Not with an accent like that. Half the crew won't understand you."
Ed returns to stomping around the deck, letting snake tats continue chit-chat bob past him like a barrel at sea. Everywhere he goes, he finds more of the crew, emerging from behind doors and from under coils of rope, bloody weapons in every hand, and varying degrees of careful on every face, as if they're expecting him to start hurling knives again. He's trying not to show it, but he's not just mad. He's kind of fucking disappointed, too. Ed's not the one who wanted to go after the warship. Ed was perfectly fucking happy with his night spent playing dress-up in his room. It was the crew that wanted something different. He was just going along with them. Frenchie pops up next to him. He's got a tiara pushing his hair back, and literally 7 big Navy medals around his neck. And one of those bejeweled daggers in hand that are pretty much only good for a toothpick. Or maybe pinning really expensive butterflies. See, this is why Ed picked him. He's not tried to kill Ed, or not that Ed's aware of. And unlike everyone else who's just standing around watching Ed kill people, he's actually good at getting his hands dirty. And best of all, he knows when Ed needs him to come and have an opinion.
"Hiya,"
Ed says, and opens his arms up to the deck.
"Can you believe this?"
Frenchie makes a weird kind of pshaw, nah, the fuck, noise.
"Can I?"
Ed nods.
"Yeah, got half a mind to leave without even searching it for cool shit to take."
Ed waits. For a protest. For a chorus of, "Aw, captains." For someone to leap up and start scrabbling through chests for something shiny while they've still got a chance. No one does anything. They all just stand there with wide eyes and look, not a twitch among them. Frenchie gurgles a laugh.
"Oh, yeah?"
Ed's insides are doing something twisty and gross. It feels like something curdling. Like he ate moldy bread yesterday because he was just so fucking hungry. Washed it down with something that burned on the way down. And today he's got to pay the price. Sit on the shitter till it all comes back out, and he vows to himself he'll never do that to himself again. He can't say that. They'll all think he's mad. Just because he's not sure he's not, Ed doesn't want to come out and say it out loud. He turns out to the stars, digs his fingernails into his palms till he can feel the half-moons come up, takes some shuddering breaths where no one can see. He's not gonna cry, though it'd serve them right if he did. "Do what you fucking like," he says, turning back to the revenge, and sticks the saber in the last remaining Spaniard as he passes. Ed doesn't like it, but the raids continue because what else are they gonna fucking do? They're pirates. They have a record to beat. He holes up in his cabin with drugs and liquor and their mirrors in his right hand, or sometimes his left, and only comes out when someone wants scaring or stabbing or torturing to death, or boiling or hatcheting or choking or beheading or overdosing or knocking overboard and drowning to death, or tying to the top of the mast by just the top joints of the fingers, filling the sails, and letting the sound of weeping on the wind lull the crew to sleep to death. Which is often. Ed guesses that's what happens when you're the boss, but no one wants you. One fun way to kill people and unnerve the crew at the same time is taking on a whole new personality for every new raid. One rainy afternoon, he's poking around the wardrobe, looking for his last slice of opium, when his elbow hits a shelf behind him. Amidst the swearing and the dropping his knife to clutch his elbow and so on, he hears something else thunk to the floor, the soft sliding thump of a lot of material a moment later. "What the fuck?" he says, as he turns to face the mirrors on the door. Although it's muffled through the literal plague doctor costumes Deed had apparently thought necessary to bring on his little pirate soiree. Because of course he did. And now Ed's wearing a plague doctor costume and feeling wistful about a kiss gone by. There's no one else around to laugh at him. The shriek picks up the slack. The beak fits uncomfortably tight to Ed's face, pressing an awkward circle into his cheeks, and there's a weird smell coming out of it that vaguely reminds Ed of winter markets. The hood is heavy and waxy to the touch, the lance sharp. The pommel embroidered with little mini-plague doctors holding mini-lances of their own. It's fucking awesome. Ed sweeps the hat low over his face, then realizes that gets in the way of the creepy-ass spectacles. The glass so thick it distorts his vision. He pushes it up his head so it's on top of his half-updo, giving his head a misshapen look that would, altogether, make Ed piss his pants if he bumped into himself without expecting it. The crew of the Ryan Dos Anjos piss their collective pants when they bump into him without expecting it. He fashions a vampire clown costume out of all the fancy man clothes he doesn't like, and makes his way around the next raid with a sweet giggle and blood running down his chin. Then he goes back to the leathers, but forgets to switch his lace undershirt for a crop top, which is annoying because he didn't especially like the way the lace felt, but he did like the way it looked. And now it's all covered in viscera. But still no one laughs at him or even really looks at him, so fuck it. He might as well feel good while he's raiding. So next time he wears a gown, a swishy green one that doesn't get in the way of a lunge or anything, and no one says anything at all except the shriek and the steed that's been lurking in all Ed's corners recently. From the cabin, before the raid, he says, "Gorgeous, Ed." And from the deck, he says, "Give us a twirl." So Ed gives him a twirl, shooting Navyman in the head as he goes, and Steed claps and fans himself with a handy pamphlet. And then back on their ship, the golden dusk warming the room, he says for the 100th time, "You are fine things well." Ed isn't actually mad. Not yet. He knows this isn't really Steed. He knows Steed isn't coming back, and wouldn't want him if he did. The words are nothing more than a memory played half to death in Ed's mind, in his bed, in 30 snatched seconds in a closet on another ship while he pretends he's living the life he once thought he might get to. The knowing is what makes the fantasy okay. He looks at himself in the lower mirror and plucks at the bottom of the skirt, swishing somewhere just below his knees.
Thanks, mate.
You're too kind, Steed corrects, and takes a slow walk around the back of Ed to examine him. This color's nice on you. I'd like you to leave it on a little longer, please.
If you say so,
Ed murmurs, and smooths the skirt back down his thigh. He stands right there, hardly breathing while Steed turns him this way and that with a hand on his upper arm, then his hip. Ed doesn't have much in the way of curves, but his imaginary Steed doesn't mind. If anything, he seems to like the skinny wastrel thing Ed has going on, more pronounced than it was when the real Steed last saw him. Perhaps he likes the difference between Ed's body and his own, being able to hoist Ed into the air, carry him across the threshold as if Ed is his young bride. Ed pulls back. The Steed that's still hidden behind him tuts and presses a hand to the small of his back, fingers wide.
Where do you think you're going?
I'm not... I don't know. I'm not going anywhere.
Do you want me to go? Ed clutches into the cool space behind him.
Come back.
Hush. Let me enjoy you. Steed takes Ed's hair down, gentle fingers pulling the knots out and soothing the hurt when Ed bites his lip. He plaits it loosely, leaving it long down Ed's back where it won't get in the way.
Sorry, it's gross. Haven't washed it in a while.
A while, like a day or two. He's not an animal. Although last time he washed it, it wasn't with water. It was in the dregs of his drink, by accident. He takes another sip right now.
Make your fingers greasy.
A terrible fate, Steed murmurs, and pets Ed's neck before letting go of the plate. Now, where did you find this dress? This is a little risque to be taking to sea. Ed wonders what he's supposed to do with that information, or where he came upon it in the first place.
Could put something else on.
It wasn't a criticism. Steed's hand slid down to Ed's waist, then his hips, and then around a little to the front, fingers resting in the grooves of his hip bones. I have plans for you. Ed catches his breath in one rough scrape. He's had this dream before. Steed pressed up behind him, feeling his way along the broken parts of Ed and putting him back together. Or in front, on his knees, the perfect curls rumpled in Ed's hands. But Ed's never been wearing a dress for it, always uncertain of whether Steed might like to see him in one. But now he knows. Steed's fingers continue moving inwards. He's got one of Ed's hands on top of his, one underneath, guiding him in firm, slow strokes that make Ed suppress his shudders with want. The dress pulls and gives in easily, falling in cool, silky swoops. Before long, their hands are bracketing Ed's cock, lifting the dress in an awkward, untidy tent. And what do we have here? Steed murmurs, and before Ed can stop him, he's pulling the dress up to reveal him, the thick cock drooling at the tip. Ed makes a noise of protest, although he can't deny he wants it. Mostly he wants to look nice for Steed, and this isn't it. His pretty dress hoiked up and just a cock and balls and hairy thighs to see. Steed doesn't seem to agree because he makes a noise of his own, pleased and thoughtful. The way he sounded when Ed surprised him with some bit of pirating knowledge that any of the rest of the crew could have given him first, if they'd had the common sense to try. Lovely, he says to follow up, and takes hold. Ed groans. His eyes slam shut, then open. He stares at the mirror, doesn't want to miss a second. Steed's hand is soft, as if he's wearing a lady's glove from some long-sunk ship. He's not been at sea long enough to get calluses, which means that he doesn't know what it's like to enjoy the rough. Ed spent every waking second of the time before with Steed, more or less, give or take, and if Steed had done this with anyone else, Ed would have known. It doesn't take long. The softness of the hand, the firmness of his voice, relentless in his expectation that Ed let him do as he please. Ed would let Steed do anything. No questions asked, and as the hand speeds up on him, he shuts his eyes again and lets his head drop against his chest, his other hand on the mirror. The shriek balloons and expands in his chest, drawing breath for him until his knees give out, and he comes across the glass in unsightly splatters. When he's got his breath back, he looks up. Steed's gone, obviously. He always is. But there's a chance he'll still come back. And Ed's still wearing the dress. The green's still pretty even now it's been used. He stares himself down in the mirror. Then he goes and gets a cloth from the washroom. The imaginary Steed isn't bad, isn't great, isn't as good as the real thing, but it's nice to have some company that isn't just, like, the poisonous, noisy part of him that woke up with this, whatever it is that you've become, is a fate worse than death, and decided to stick around. Because Ed agrees, he should have let the English kill him. His list of reasons to stay alive hasn't got longer than 3. With the imaginary Steed here, he can pretend they're together still, that they're having fun together like before. And some things that didn't happen before. Lying back in bed and letting Steed fuck him. Begging him for more. Harder. Again. Throwing his head back in the pillows. Feeling the warmth of Steed's body. The sureness of his touch. The taste of his mouth on Ed's. Anything that isn't one more night afraid and alone. Steed would give him another reason. Ed looks at the space beside him up on deck. Lots of space. Lots of people scared to get close to him these days. Not Steed, who's never been afraid of him, even when he should. Whenever Steed comes back, he'll press up close and familiar and jostle Ed's elbow and say something like, "Hi, gorgeous. Did you miss me?" They'll be together. They'll be happy. The shriek will drown in it, gurgling the death rattle in all Ed's happiness. Not that Ed's gonna notice. Too busy feeling happy to think about when he wasn't. Steed's not here yet, though. So Ed looks out to the ocean, the choking purple clouds, what remains of the crew scattered on the deck below, high waters and opposing winds. Peace lies one way, the storm the other. Ed twists the wheel. The end.